You're listening to a program created at IONS, the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Thank you for supporting our research in consciousness and its practical applications for education, healthcare, and a more sustainable world. For more information, visit us at www.noetic.org.
Welcome to the Institute of Noetic Sciences' new teleseminar series, The Noetic Science Behind the Book, The Lost Symbol. We are very excited to begin this 12-week series with ION's president, Marilyn Mandala-Schlitz, live from Washington, D.C., the location of Dan Brown's thriller novel. Welcome, Marilyn.
Thank you so much.
We have a lot of questions for you about the science behind the book, but first, just casually, what did you think of Dan Brown's book?
Well, what is not to love about Dan Brown's book, really? I have been a big fan of Dan Brown, and what is really gratifying for us in this moment is his role as an ambassador for really planting us in the midst of the mainstream and, you know, capturing people's imagination with this fictional story, but really, combining that with a compelling narrative about why noetic science is important and, you know, kind of really drawing people into some of the research through a less direct route than, you know, simply talking about the science.
I'll tell you a little bit about Marilyn for those of you who are new. For three decades, scientist and anthropologist Marilyn Mandala-Schlitz, PhD, has pioneered clinical and field-based research in the area of human transformation and healing. She is a thought leader on matters of individual and social change, whose respected voice offers new insights into the most pressing challenges of our time. A researcher, speaker, change consultant, and writer, Marilyn's books include Living Deeply, The Art and Science of Transformation in Everyday Life, and Consciousness and Healing, Integral Approaches to Mind-Body Medicine. She serves as the CEO and president of the Institute of Noetic Sciences, where she has worked for 15 years. So 3 weeks ago, Dan Brown's book was released, and since then there has been an increased interest in noetic sciences. His book focuses on the themes of magic, the occult, astrology, secrets, and symbols. He wraps the whole set of mysteries in a veil of noetic sciences because it's a mystery to many people. Marilyn, for the new members on this call, could you please define noetic sciences?
I'd be delighted. I think that, you know, the idea of exploring our inner experiences and our consciousness has been part of every tradition. We find it in Hinduism, Buddhism, but I think we trace our roots most directly to the ancient Greeks, and they were very methodical about exploring different ways of knowing or engaging the world. And so on one hand, we know that we are analytical and that we have this kind of discursive intellect that involves kind of the language that goes through our heads when we're thinking, or how we make decisions based on kind of rational impulse or reasoning, not impulse, but reasoning. And then there's this other way of knowing, this other way in which we navigate through life. And that's really what they called the noetic, or nous, nous being the direct knowing, like an intuitive gut-level experience of trusting that there's something important here, but maybe not having all the facts figured out. It's that sense of direct experience. My favorite author on noetic principles was William James, who's really kind of credited as being the father of psychology in America. And William James defined noetic as states of insight unplumbed by the discursive intellect, all inarticulate though they remain, and yet they carry with them a curious sense of authority. So for William James, it was really the idea that there are these direct experiences that often guide us to make big life decisions, and yet when asked why, you know, we may not have a really strong analytical, logical explanation, and yet these things really lead us. And the bridge then between this kind of noetic knowing, the idea that there are these inner experiences or states of awareness that are important to us, really became a bridge concept when Edgar Mitchell came back from the moon. And Edgar, you know, had the opportunity to walk on the moon, and he describes having the window seat on the way home. And here he was, an MIT-trained engineer who had tremendous faith and confidence in the objective world outside, the power of logic and reason, the value of Newtonian cause and effect kind of physics. And yet, as he was coming back from the moon, he had this kind of epiphany in which he felt himself interconnected with all of the universe. And it was a kind of experience that had been described by mystics, you know, throughout the ages. And yet here was this, you know, rational, intellectual man who was describing this inner experience, but without any language or framework for really understanding it. So when he came back to planet Earth, he felt like perhaps the great frontier isn't our exploration of outer space, but really understanding more in a very serious way about the nature of inner experience. What are the powers and potentials of our beliefs to shape our reality? How is it that we can have these kind of intuitive insights that lead to creative breakthroughs in every different discipline, and yet science has largely ignored or neglected these aspects of inner awareness? And so the Institute of Noetic Sciences has really been dedicated to building this bridge between these kind of deep mystical experiences and the rigor and discernment that comes from Western science. And in this moment, this is the potential for really stimulating breakthroughs. And in particular, and just a final thing to say about it, is that as we look at the major crises on our planet today, it becomes really clear that most of the problems are not inherent in planet Earth or something external from ourselves, but they really come from our own worldview, our consciousness, our belief systems, and that maybe the greatest opportunity for beginning to solve some of these huge problems we face is to seriously dive into who we are, how it is that we think and believe and create together, and then in that spirit of creativity, to really look for new solutions to age-old problems. So that's the work today of the Institute of Noetic Sciences, is to build that bridge.
Wonderful definition of noetics and a nice overview of ions. Could you give some other specific examples of noetic experiences in addition to what you mentioned about Edgar's experience?
Well, we hear about lots of different ways in which people have these kinds of openings to the possibility that, you know, our consciousness has these kind of powers and potentials. We hear about healing, where people are able to harness their emotions and their beliefs in ways that promote healing and well-being. You know, people talk about these gut feelings or gut reactions. You know, I just knew it in my gut, and that's why I took the actions that I did. We would certainly define that as a kind of noetic experience. You know, there's the common folklore aspect of, you know, what's called women's intuition, you know, oftentimes. And they associate this with the feminine, but it's widespread across genders. It's not just women who have these intuitive insights. In fact, there have been surveys done of very successful business people, and one of the things that they describe is that oftentimes the big decisions that they make aren't based on having all the facts, but are really at some level based on this kind of feeling that this is the right decision or that's the right decision. And so what our role has been is to try and understand ways in which we can discriminate when those impulses are reliable and when they're not. How is it that we can really begin to recognize that a lot of the major breakthroughs, whether it's in science or art or education, literature, come when people have these incubated ideas. So it may be that somebody like a physicist has lots of information, but oftentimes they describe having had a dream, for example, in which the breakthrough comes to them directly through some kind of consciousness-based experience. And so those are the kind of things that we have really been interested in understanding from a scientific perspective, and also really honoring that there are multiple ways of gaining truth about the world. And so how is it that we can find a calibration between that kind of intuitive impulse and then good, solid information? And so we really are about finding that balance between them.
Let's get into the specifics of the book, which takes place in Washington, D.C., where you are today. Can you share some of your experiences and observations of the metaphysical images in our nation's capital?
Well, I want to say that I think, you know, we really are at this great moment when there are many different realities that are converging. And when you look around at sort of what are the principles that founded this nation, it was really based on a spirit of pluralism. And again, going back to William James, he was really interested in the idea that the universe is plural and that there are multiple ways to understand reality. You know, William James talked about reality as something distributive. It's something that you can understand from different dimensions. You know, a quote from him is, everything is many-dimensional in its external relations. And so when we think about the founding of this country, it was very much based on the notion that, you know, the great melting pot was a way of recognizing and appreciating all these differences. And then being here in Washington, D.C., it's so thrilling to see the ways in which our imagination has taken these notions of the different ways of knowing and engaging reality and imprinted it in our architecture, in the various statues and symbolisms at the Supreme Court. You can see the iconography everywhere that speaks to the transcendence of human nature. We see it in the monuments and this issue that Dan Brown explores in The Lost Symbol of the ways in which, you know, the divine is both within and without, and that ultimately, you know, we are collaborators in this great unfolding. When we were working on the Living Deeply book and our study of spiritual transformation, which is also a big theme in Dan's book, one of the people I talked to was Jeff Kripal, who's a comparative religion scholar at Rice University. And one of the things he told me is that it is an aspect of a free democracy that allows us to even ask the question of, you know, what is my spirituality? What is my way of engaging reality? What are the aspects of truth in these various traditions? This comes from the kind of liberty that we sometimes take for granted, but in a kind of fundamentalist community, people are not entitled to ask those questions that think out of the orthodoxy. And so one of the beauties of, you know, being here in Washington, D.C., the seat of this republic that we love and care for, is really the idea that it's out of that pluralism into the unity that we can begin to express our greatest potential. So I'm really excited to be here. I'm excited at the ways in which this idea of this transcendent spirit is represented both physically in the buildings, but metaphysically in the imaginal ways in which these different sculptures and etchings on the sides of the buildings, you know, represents our desire and potential to be great, and not great in the sense that I'm better than you are, but to be great in that sense of living into the fullness of our potential. And I think that is the seed of our democracy, and I think it's the seed of what Dan Brown is trying to explore in The Lost Symbol.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and as you mentioned, the book refers to symbols of transformation, and someone in the book states that that noetics is the missing link between modern science and ancient mysticism. So can you define transformation and describe some of the research that has been done on transformation at ION?
Well, I think it's a really deep question and one that you know, requires sort of unpacking, because I was on the plane coming to D.C. yesterday and I was reading Time magazine, and there were several examples in there of transformational movements. One was Charles Manson. And Charles Manson, in his, you know, efforts to, you know, change the world in the sort of misguided ways that he did, was really about a transformative model. And he believed that he could sort of help people by doing some things that were very, very destructive. Nazi Germany was a transformative movement, and one that was ultimately very harmful for a very large percent of the population. In this book, they talk about terrorism as an actual way in which people are transformed and, you know, little bit by little bit, incrementally shaping a new worldview that ultimately ends up being very dysfunctional. So clearly that's not the kind of transformation that we're aspiring to. It's not the emphasis that we've taken in our own work. When we have looked at transformation, it's first of all to distinguish our work from those other kind of restrictive and exclusionary types of models. But in particular, then, what we did is to look at what were the commonalities across different spiritual traditions that embrace the notion that we can transform in ways that become pro-social, that become supportive of the collective endeavor, that allow us to begin to explore the multiple ways of knowing and being that rest within each of us. One of the things that in Dan Brown's book he talks quite a bit about is this idea of entanglement. And we know now through quantum theory that entanglement is something that is really guiding a great deal of our understanding of the nature of reality. Transformation from this sort of pro-social perspective is really about people's recognition of their uniqueness. But at a deep and fundamental level, it's about their interconnectedness. And this is something, again, going back to, you know, a work that is fiction. Dan Brown is definitely writing a fictional story, but he's drawing on a lot of insights that have come from the world's esoteric traditions. And, you know, he talks about entanglement, this sense of unity, as, you know, man's oldest spiritual quest is to perceive our own entanglement. To really understand at a deep level our interconnectedness. So on one hand, going back to William James and this notion of pluralism, there are multiple ways of knowing, and in the Dan Brown book too, the idea of these kind of holograms, so that each bit of information, as I speak right now, people have all their own associations that they're making to it, and memories that get triggered, and, you know, reactions to something I may have said that they agree or disagree with. You know, all of those represent the plurality of our engagement at one level. And then when we start to dig deeper, we see this entanglement and interconnectedness as a core foundation. So it's the paradox in transformation of really discovering and revealing our own uniqueness, each individual's birthright to be distinctive. You know, we all have different fingerprints and eyes, and at the same time to recognize what the mystics have been telling us, which is that we are fundamentally interconnected. And as we begin to live into the that assumption and that realization, it begins to change our behaviors in ways that ultimately can enhance the well-being of our planet and the ways in which we can live together in the 21st century. So I think that there are some really beautiful notions of what transformation entails in terms of our ability to flourish and grow as a species.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and one of the other things that Dan Brown brought up, you mentioned a lot of them, entanglement and unity, holograms. He also brought up universal consciousness. And we're so grateful for him to introducing that idea to the mainstream and that it's not this ethereal New Age concept. Can you tell us about some of the rigorous scientific practices and experiments which have explored this idea?
Well, first, just to, you know, kind of complete my riff on transformation, and it leads right into that, which is ultimately the way in which we defined transformation in our book, Living Deeply, was a shift in perspective. It's really our capacity to see things in a different way. And so growing up in a culture that has really been defined by kind of rugged individualism, we have often looked for our own individual paths. And yet what we see is some of the greatest accomplishments in human history have come when we have been able to galvanize our collective intention in ways that can do more than the sum of its parts. So, you know, going back to the foundation of the Institute of Noetic Sciences and to think about, you know, the times, the 60s and 1970s and, you know, nobody had gone to the moon. Nobody had utilized, you know, physics and engineering in a way that would allow us to take men to the moon and bring them successfully home. And Kennedy at that time really called us to engage our collective imagination and to come together with a kind of common intention that said, if we can do this together, if we can put our multiple intentions together toward a common goal, perhaps we can achieve the impossible. And that is, in fact, what happened. We were able, over the period of a relatively short amount of time, a decade, 10 years, to rally all of our resources together such that we successfully sent moon and brought the men to the moon and brought them safely home. To me, this is an example of how sort of collective consciousness can be harnessed to accomplish things that are for the greater good. So that's kind of one level, and you can think about it at the level of, you know, collective action. So lots of people in various places were developing pieces of a large puzzle that, you know, ultimately was the Apollo program. You can think about it at the level of the imagination. You can think about it as a manifestation of something like science fiction. You know, many people have been asking about, you know, this is a novel and, you know, how is it that, you know, in a novel, in a fictional work, that there are things about science that we want to develop in this program. And about that, I would say science fiction is really an important way in which we began to imagine together, to dream together about something that was beyond our capacity at that moment. And so I think that this idea of collective consciousness and the notion that multiple consciousnesses directed toward a common outcome can really be harnessed in ways that are very positive for the future of humanity is a big piece of what needs to be explored more deeply as we try to translate what is fiction into what is good science. He also talks about, so that's kind of at the level of our collaborative spirit and the ways in which we can come together in a unified way. He also talks about the kind of transpersonal aspects of collective consciousness. And, you know, there are aspects of where he goes in his discussions that really are, you know, in the realm of fiction. But there are aspects of it that have also begun to be explored with, you know, depth through the lens of science. And one example of that is the project on the Global Consciousness Study, where it was observed that people who have a common attention, they're focused on a particular outcome together, like the Apollo program, seem to be able to shift things subtly. And so the question was then, is there something about our intention that can be measured physically, and is there a way in which multiple intentions can be amassed such that they can create a bigger effect? And so the Global Consciousness Project was born out of Roger Nelson and Dean Radin and Dick Bierman's work. And we're going to talk more about that in the series and in more depth. But one of the things that they noticed is that, and again, this comes from the work of Helmut Schmidt as well, a quantum physicist who was really interested in mind over matter. Is it possible that our intention can influence the physical world? And one way in which Helmut was able to explore that is to create these random event generators, or these electronic coin flippers. And the idea was to see if people's intention could skew the probability distribution such that you'd end up with more heads than tails. You know, if you were flipping a coin 100 times and the coin is balanced, you'd expect pretty much an equal number of heads and tails. But what these scientists began to see is that by exerting intention toward more heads than tails, for example, they began to see that to a very small degree, but over a lot of trials significant, was the ability for us to harness our intention to influence the physical world, to influence these quantum physical processes that we could then measure. So the Global Consciousness Project took that idea that somehow consciousness is able to influence matter in ways that are measurable, and it then asked the question, if that's the case, what if lots of consciousnesses influence a particular outcome or focus on a particular outcome? Does that begin to change the distribution of these random events? And now there are hundreds of these random event generators all over the planet, and it has been documented and now studied and analyzed by, you know, skeptical folks who are really interested in looking at the details of the methodology. And it's actually been shown on a number of occasions that when there is this collective attention toward a particular thing, whether it was 9/11 or the death of Princess Di or some kind of natural disaster that rallied everybody's attention toward a particular event, that it begins to create order out of these random processes to an extent that is distributed across this network of random generators in the globe. So Dean Radin talks about if you took a bunch of buoys out on the ocean, and generally speaking, they're all kind of bobbing on their own. So you can imagine each of these is a random event generator, and they're all doing their own thing. But when a great tsunami comes, you begin to see that all those little buoys start to work together with coherence so that they're all moving in a similar wave. And that's what it appears to be the case of these random event generators, is that they're all, during these moments of mass attention, beginning to move in coherence with one another in ways that begin to look non-random. So this suggests that our consciousness is causal in ways that can be measured, that it engages in the physical world in ways that haven't been easily understood by a conventional scientific explanations, and that there is this potential that a multitude of attentions toward a particular outcome can have a larger effect than any individual. And at this point, it's still early in the science. It's still an area that deserves a lot more attention than it's gotten so far, but it looks like a very exciting and potentially fascinating new way of understanding ourselves and how it is that we can be together.
It is. It's all very exciting. For those who have read the book, and this won't spoil anything for those of you who haven't, Catherine, the character who is the noetic scientist, has her lab in a vast empty space and utilizes a cube. Can you tell our listeners, Marilyn, about ION's research facility and why it's necessary to isolate people during certain experiments?
Well, I've been in a little communication with Dan Brown now, and I told him that we have now affectionately renamed our shielded room the Cube, in respect and appreciation for him. So one of the things that, you know, we've been really interested in as we have developed a scientific approach to these questions of consciousness is really wanting to make sure that, you know, what we're studying is what we think we're studying, and that if we're talking about something like intention at a distance or the possibility that one person's prayers can influence another person's body from a distance, if you're trying to look at something like that and you're trying to make, you're formulating a hypothesis and then wanting to test it, you want to make sure that there aren't alternative explanations or extraneous variables in the scientific language that could account for some kind of correlation. So in other words, if I am a healer and I'm attempting to heal somebody else, and that person notices something, they feel better in the ideal. The question is that due to their wishful thinking? Is that due to some kind of self-healing that is triggered by my expectancy or their expectancy? Or is it some kind of X factor that has yet to be understood, some kind of entanglement that, that we talk about in quantum physics and, you know, certainly Dan Brown develops in his book? And so that has been a hypothesis we've been interested in. We took claims made by all these healers from different traditions that they can use their minds, their beliefs, their intentions to, in a sense, reach out and connect with another person in ways that have physical implications. And because there are all these other variables that can come into it, we were really interested in how would you rule those out. So we created our lab at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and we have a 2,000-pound electromagnetically shielded room that we do a lot of our research in. And one of the reasons that we have that cube, as it were, is because we want to be able to rule out conventional explanations. If we can see a healer affecting another person's physiology from a distance, we want to really be sure that we know we've ruled out all the conventional explanations. And so if, for example, somebody came into the shielded room and they had a cell phone with them, perhaps they're calling the healer to tell them, okay, I'm ready now, in which case, if there was a correlation between the two people, we could explain that via sensory interaction. One person talked to the other. The fact of the matter is that in the shielded room, if you had a cell phone and you walked into the room and you closed the door, you know how you have the little bars on your cell phone that show your receptivity? You will very quickly see that there is zero receptivity once the door is shut. So we are able to use that room and that protocol to begin to bring science to bear on the kind of claims and experiences that people have reported through history.
One of the characters in the book is afraid of the noetic sciences research, and at one point he says, what happens to the human condition if the great mysteries of life are finally revealed? Can you address what that character represents and his fears?
Well, I mean, we all know from our own personal experiences that we can be fearful of the unknown. And so when something comes up for us that we don't understand or that doesn't make sense, that can be very scary. So I think that's part of it. I think there is a sense that, you know, we're engaged in the mystery and we like to keep mystery happening. And so there's also that fear that somehow we're going to lose our magical sense of engagement if science sheds too much light on it. For myself, I always like to think about science as a spiritual practice that involves a deep engagement with the mystery, and that in fact there are insights and revelations that have come through many of the mystery schools, the esoteric traditions, the spiritual traditions, that now have great relevance for understanding how it is that we can move forward into humanity. So I think one of the things we've been trying to do is to learn from these different mystery schools about qualities that can be developed within ourselves such that we can live happier, healthier lives. I'm here in Washington to attend a meeting with His Holiness the Dalai Lama and a group of educators from a variety of different centers around the country, really looking at how it is that we can begin to bring some of these contemplative practices and principles of self-regulation into our schools so that we can help our children to live more emotionally balanced lives, so that we can learn to appreciate the differences between us in ways that ultimately may facilitate breakthroughs, like new ways of knowing and experiencing. So I have absolutely no fear of engaging in these ideas. And one final thing is that oftentimes in history, the reason these ideas have been secret is because the dominant culture wouldn't allow them to be expressed. And one of the beauties of Dan Brown and a variety of other kind of popular culture events that are happening, you know, right now in this moment, is that some of these principles that have been put down and hidden because people are afraid for their careers or their future are now moving into the mainstream. We are like the emergent mainstream. And with that comes the freedom to explore a new set of questions and to do it by bridging these different ways of knowing, by taking the insights that come from the spiritual and wisdom traditions together with the kind of, you know, rigor and discernment that comes from Western science, not because one is dominant over the other, but because when they meet one another, we can illuminate new insights about the future of humanity.
Learning more about noetics will allow the fans of The Lost Symbol to gain a deeper understanding of the powerful connections between noetics and ancient mystical and spiritual traditions. Can you tell us, or our listeners, Marilyn, how can people get more involved with the Institute of Noetic Sciences?
Well, one of the things we represent, I think, is a collaborative community that can begin to share this kind of common collective intention. And so there is a solidarity that comes from a fellowship around an exploration of these ideas. And so the Institute of Noetic Sciences, I think, is a kind of global learning community. And as people come into membership in the organization, they can feel that sense of affinity and support, particularly to explore ideas that have often been ridiculed in the mainstream. So there's that sense of community that our membership have really expressed great appreciation for. So really encouraging people to, you know, to become members and to join community groups and begin to engage these conversations in a deep way. We are in the process of developing a set of educational programs. Tonight is the beginning of a conversation around the Dan Brown book, The Lost Symbol. We intend in January to begin a much more detailed exploration with an actual course that we will be doing with a reader and a variety of different scientists giving us more and more detail, and scholars, philosophers, telling us about the importance of, you know, bodily transformation, the ways in which, you know, we can change our bodies. You know, we hear about plastic surgery, but we know that from every culture, transformation has often involved, you know, bodily alteration. So we're going to dive in and explore that. A very exciting area right now in neuroscience and in social psychology is this issue of good and evil. And it's a fundamental tension that gets played out in Dan Brown's book and in many works of fiction. We're really interested in looking at what neuroscience can tell us. What do social psychologists have to tell us about how it is that people make, you know, ethical choices? We have learned some phenomenal things about the neuroscience of evil, and we're going to explore that in detail through some of the work. We're also getting ready to launch an educational program for health and healing practitioners on a variety of topics related to consciousness and healing. But in particular, we're launching the first set are going to be on afterlife cosmologies as they relate to end-of-life care. And so we're looking at different maps of the afterlife from different cultural perspectives, hearing from representatives of different traditions about their cosmology. We're talking to scientists about how would you bring an evidence-based approach to these, you know, age-old questions about what happens when we die. And then finally, we have talked to a variety of health and healing practitioners, physicians, nurses, clergy, social workers, lay healers, hospice practitioners, about why is this important? How does this help us to live better lives? And how does it help us to engage people who are at end of life and really trying to understand what is their own relationship to their mortality? So these are the kinds of questions that we think are uniquely noetic, that offer that bridge between the world's spiritual and esoteric traditions and Western science, and that ultimately can be seen as a vehicle for promoting both individual and social healing. And so, you know, these are some ways that people can engage our work and come together to share in a learning community such that we can all inform one another. Do you have anything to add to that, Angela? You've been doing such an incredible job helping, you know, choreograph and orchestrate some of the threads that connect us. And is there something I missed there that you could share about how it is that people can get more involved in the work of the Institute of Noetic Sciences?
Volunteering is always a great thing to do at IONS. It's a wonderful opportunity for people who are either close to the campus. You know, we often need help with administrative responsibilities or helping with events that we have. Or if you're not near the campus, things like transcriptions. It's something that we need a lot of as we're doing all these interviews with a lot of the different leaders and teachers and psychologists. Those interviews need to be transcribed to help with the research and also to help us disseminate that information to you, as we will be doing in this teleseminar series.
That's right. And I think, you know, certainly all of our transformation research could not have happened if we hadn't had sort of that collective intention of a number of really thoughtful volunteers who really helped us to enhance, you know, the experience of what we were doing. And another thing in terms of how we are using these educational programs, again, you know, referring to Dan Brown's work, he's talking about how intention can be a learned skill and that we can harness our intentions by really beginning to dig deeper and to engage in practices together. And so, you know, through our membership, through our volunteer network, through our community group network, through people's interest in following our website, engaging in the, you know, noetic.org and, you know, informing us through, you know, blogging and the community forums on Shift in Action, all of these become ways in which we're informing one another and really creating that kind of collective intention.
Is there anything else about the book that you'd like to discuss that we haven't covered before we go into Q&A?
Well, I just feel really, you know, grateful for the times that we're living in and grateful to Dan Brown, who has really, you know, been quite a leader in bringing noetic into the common vernacular, really helping people to question, what does it mean, this word noetic? You know, most people don't know what it means. And for him to really help bring that into our conversation, not just the Institute of Noetic Sciences conversation, but more of the, you know, the global readership, I think that that is a huge service, because it gives us a framework for beginning to reflect on our own inner experience, on what inspires us, what motivates us, what leads us to, you know, do great things or not. And so I'm very appreciative of the power of story to attract our imagination in ways that ultimately can be harnessed for the greater good. And so that's, you know, in terms of kind of my takeaway, I'm just very excited about the potentials of this moment and really optimistic that good things can come from this.
Great. Thank you. So now it's time for your questions. If you have a question for Marilyn, just press 1 on your keypad, and Jeffrey will unmute you in the order that he sees the hands coming up.
Okay, great. We have our first question from Anna Stevenson. You have the mic.
Hi, thanks. And Marilyn, thank you so much for all the outreach that you've done since you took over the CEO position. So I love seeing you on Twitter and, you know, bringing a lot of other folks into this. And with the Dan Brown book, I think it's going to bring a lot of new people into ION, so I'm very excited about it, and that you're capitalizing on this this book in this way. So I think that's great. My question is, how can we bring some of these educational programs down to the local level, because I belong to a local ION's group, mm-hmm. and how can we bring these things in?
Oh, that is such a great question. First, thank you for your comment. And then, so I think the answer to that question is sort of threefold. One is that we are deeply committed in this moment to translating a lot of our research and the insights into curriculum for K through 12 public school education. We had the privilege of being hosted by the Sacramento ION's community group last week, and through the good graces of Bob Blackstone and his wife and his daughter and the whole team there at the community group level, we were able to go out and speak with 870 kindergarten through sixth grade students about transformation and about the idea that we need to build skills that allow us to respect the fact that people have different worldviews and perspectives on reality, and that there are ways in which we can learn to celebrate those differences. And I can tell you, it was riveting for us. My intern colleague Liz Miller and I were there, and, you know, seeing these kindergartners sit down and begin to close their eyes and get into this kind of meditative place was absolutely exhilarating. And so we're now in the process of doing a Train the Trainers program, where we're hoping to create a group of folks who will take the content of our curriculum out into their schools, such that we can begin to, you know, expand the work. So that's one thing. A second thing really does speak to a goal we have in launching our new website early next year. And that is that I see the Internet and this kind of program we're doing right now, but let's just say the Internet for the moment, as a kind of electronic wrap around the world that connects our learning community. And so as we can begin to dive into learning experiences together, so let's just take that afterlife cosmology idea. So we have a set of lesson plans, and our goal is to begin to engage community groups all over the planet in exploring the content of those learning programs together, you know, in more or less real time, because there are different time zones across the world, and then to have local conversation, or perhaps it's individuals studying on their own in the comfort of their homes. But say it's a community group. Let's just go with that. Say a community group takes on a course. And they together are able to then discuss the content of that course together and their insights and, you know, reflections. And then the following week, for example, we can engage one of these teleseminars where you're not just talking to the people in your local community group, but you may be talking to somebody in Australia or, you know, in Brazil or in Africa. And so we begin to explore a common content together. And then the idea would be, I guess so this is the third thing, is to begin to be ambassadors with that content into your local communities. So again, taking this idea of the afterlife cosmologies, to become a trainer who can take that content into your local hospice, for example, and facilitate conversations with people who have never really considered this whole body of knowledge. And to me, the idea that we could together be learning and reflecting and feeding back to each other and really embracing the globe becomes a really powerful way of interconnecting the dots. And so that's one way that we're really thinking about how to move it forward. Thank you so much for that question. I loved that question, obviously.
Great. Thank you, Ma'ana. And we have our next question from Alicia Hirshhorn. Alicia, you have the mic.
Okay, I'm wondering if you know of anyone who is studying the work of superconductors that can change gold to iridium, and I think that changes their weight and how that works to develop travel between dimensions.
No, I don't. I absolutely don't have any background or experience. There may be somebody else on the call, and when we open up for the group discussion, maybe somebody can address that. But that's way beyond my competence level. But thanks for the question. It's a visionary one.
Okay, we have our next question. If you registered under the name Press, you have the mic.
This is Allison Rose Levy from the Huffington Post. Thank you. This is a terrific, terrific explication of this great moment of opportunity, Marilyn. It's just wonderful. I have a question, which is we're obviously thrilled with Dan Brown for using this fictional opportunity to draw attention to this very expansive, really future field of endeavor. But a lot of the book is actually devoted to a sort of you know, search through the archives of past symbols and images, you know, that are kind of noetically charged for people, but which in the end don't actually produce much juice. And also in the book, we have a model of someone seeking a personal enlightenment, you know, kind of above all else and without any ethical considerations. And you know, you did mention ethics and good versus evil as being one of the areas of, you know, kind of future inquiry and study. I'd love to hear your comments about the model of, you know, great teachers or people of great attainment or single individuals as a model for spiritual evolution and the collective model of people evolving as a collective and in a community and in a pro-social way. I'd love to hear more about, you know, that dimension of your work.
Right. Well, there was a lot in that. Thank you. Well, some people talk about, you know, the next coming, the second coming of, you know, God, Christ, Buddha, as instead of thinking that it's going to be an individual, that it may well be a sangha, it may be a community, it may be a collective who recognize that each of them has a piece, and together through that kind of pro-social behavior, practice, engagement, can begin to manifest the kind of qualities that, you know, involve compassion and empathy and, you know, these kind of pro-social qualities that I think ultimately will lead to a better future. This topic of good and evil fascinates me, and I'm interested in Jim Fallon's work at the University of California at Irvine, and he's been doing both neuroscience and molecular biology on serial killers and looking to see if there are qualities that they have in common, both in terms of their, you know, brain wiring as well as in terms of their genetic predispositions. And he is arguing that there are commonalities across them, and that so on one hand it looks like, okay, yeah, people are either born good or they're born evil, but that's just too simple. And what we're learning about, again, through the neurosciences and also through biology, this whole epigenetics work on how our environment and our collective informs the expression of our genes, for example. So much talk has gone into, you know, DNA and how, you know, the structure of the DNA predetermines, you know, our health, our illness, our psychological orientation, our moods. And yet what we're discovering is that the RNA becomes a very important aspect of what gets turned on. And so the expression of these genes is both inherited and socially embedded. And so if you take somebody who, you know, potentially has a predisposition for genocide, and you put them in a society that is Darfur, you can expect that those kinds of qualities that may be biologically based are going to be privileged under those set of circumstances. And so I think that it's really important to hold that there are aspects of inheritance that come into this conversation about good and evil. And more importantly, we're discovering that the context and container in which we are encouraged or discouraged really informs what gets expressed. And so I think that's extremely important. And then I want to touch on your question about the teachers. When we were doing our work on for the Living Deeply book, we interviewed 60 masters from different world traditions. And, you know, these people were really inspirations for us. They were models for us. And this is another piece that we're discovering in terms of education is that, and again, you can find the blend between the social science and the, you know, neuroscience today, but seeing somebody, experiencing somebody who can be a role model, either for the good or the bad, shapes people's experiences, behaviors, practices, orientations toward life. You know, their very worldview is informed by that. So these teachers who become exemplars are very, very important. And at the same time, I think there has been an impulse to try and find the source of that insight from outside of us and to look for the guidance and the wisdom of the other. And the whole principle for me of noetic science is really that we need to begin to calibrate our own inner authority and to be less likely to delegate the authority for our decisions to somebody else, and instead to really begin to reflect and build capacities that allow this kind of reflection and calibration and emotional coherence and regulation that can allow us to ultimately be better citizens. And, you know, to kind of wrap all of that together, I'll go back to the worldview literacy program we're doing with these kids, K through 12. And we have done now work in the Oakland inner city schools, for example, at the high school level, and then compare them with what the experience was we had with these kindergarten through sixth graders. And at that early stage, they didn't have a lot of racism and prejudice and ethnicity or negative ethnicity in that sense of, you know, one over another. They just were like warm and open vessels. And so to the extent we can begin to bring the wisdom and the discernment that comes from this interface between the spiritual traditions and the scientific insight to this next generation who are, you know, being formed in this moment. Those are the kind of skill sets that I think are going to make for a better citizenry in the 21st century and that ultimately can lead to the kind of expression of, you know, positive, bountiful future that I think certainly within the Institute of Noetic Sciences community, I think we really aspire to and hold as possible. So I hope that answered the question. That was a lot of stuff brought together, but thank you for that.
Thank you.
And thank you, Marilyn, so much for taking your time while you're in Washington, D.C. and starting out this series on such a dynamic path.
Oh, well, I'm just thrilled to be here, and thank you. I mean, I got a voicemail from Dan Brown today, actually, and he said, well, I hope you're enjoying the attention. And he laughed, and he was very, very sweet about it. So I think that he has really given us a gift, and I feel that the gift is one that, you know, is part of our collective engagement with these ideas. And so I'm just really grateful to all of you for listening and, you know, for the times that we're living in, because it's really a remarkable opportunity for us to grow together.
We hope you enjoyed this program from IONS. Located in Petaluma, California, the Institute of Noetic Sciences is a nonprofit membership organization that conducts scientific research into the potentials and powers of consciousness. To learn more about IONS, please visit us at www.noetic.org or call toll-free 877-769-4667.